From Illinois to Louisiana, Iowa to Alaska, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, giving children of active duty military personnel more educational options is the goal of proposed education savings accounts. Peter Murphy of the Invest in Education Foundation is here with details. President Trump reluctantly signed that budget-busting omnibus spending bill, but Andy Roth has the real story on why line-item veto powers would give the president the ability to rein in spending. A recent fatal accident has prompted calls for suspending research on driverless vehicles. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine joins us to explain why the experiments should continue. And presidents in the 21st century have commemorated Easter in very different ways. Colin Hanna reflects on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Active duty service members move frequently, creating special challenges in providing their children with a quality education. Peter Murphy is Vice President for Policy at the Invest in Education Foundation. He is here to explain why special education savings accounts would help. Peter, welcome to American Radio Journal. Peter, of course, our country always has a large number of our men and women serving us in a military capacity, not only around the country, but overseas. What sort of unique challenges do military families have when it comes to providing K-12 education for their children?
Right now, Loman, it's an all-volunteer force, as you know, and it behooves the government, the administration, to attract and retain quality military personnel. That's essential for readiness. That's essential for our national security. And to have quality and experienced personnel, you're really talking about young men and women in their late 20s, early 30s, who are childbearing age. And these are people that are ready to raise families, and we have to make it worth their while to stay in the force. We have to retain that experience and that investment that we've made in our military from the very beginning when they enlisted or when they got out of service academy or however they got in. And so as they have children, their children's education is paramount, and it's a leading factor in whether they decide to stay in the military. Because, as you know, what happens is they get reassigned, they get redeployed, they move around a lot. I mean, any military brat, quote-unquote, that you ever knew in life went to multiple schools, lived in multiple places when they grew up, and then that's very much still the case. And so we've really got to address the issue in a variety of ways, but one of which is their children's education. How can we best make that a quality, seamless experience as possible? And that's what we've been working on.
As we look at those options, Peter, and of course, we all want our military to have the best of everything that they can have, especially in education for their children. You specifically referenced the fact that the military, they get reassigned, they move around a lot, which makes brick and mortar schools something that they have to change frequently. Are there other options for military families that might provide their children with more stability when it comes to their education?
Specifically, what we're trying to do is we are backing legislation to provide something called an education savings account to military families who want to access this for something in lieu of the school district where they live. Perhaps most military families, or a good portion of them, they may be perfectly happy with the public school district that they have for their child, but oftentimes they don't have much of a choice, and it may not be a good place to be for them. And so as an added incentive, as an added quality of life issue, the education savings account would empower families at really a fairly modest amount of money, $4,500 a family or so, for them to put their child in a private school or pay for homeschool expenses, pay for online learning, or even pay the district school for, say, a part-time coursework. The beauty of that approach is you're really offering a variety of expenses that the family can afford now for their child's education in lieu of a district that they're not satisfied with.
And as we look at making it possible for military families and, frankly, for parents all across the country to be able to have more options, what is currently going on? You mentioned a bill in Congress. Of course, getting Congress to act on anything is extraordinarily difficult. There have been a lot of other issues that have been dominating the agenda. So where, Peter, does all of this stand in Congress in terms of getting these savings accounts authorized and making more options available to military families and to others?
Well, Congressman Jim Banks of Indiana, he is himself a military man. I believe he still does National Guard duty, or he did as a congressman. He's introduced the Education Savings Account bill for military families. It's H.R. 5199. He's introduced this bill, and he's already has between 40 and 50 co-sponsors, which is unusual. Right out of the gate, a lot of members signed on to this. And what it would provide is, it starts off with probably 100,000 of our military families who live in or near military bases, kind of high concentration military areas. And it would make them eligible, if they chose, to access an education savings account. And that bill has an uphill climb. I mean, legislate, there's lots of bills out there. Congress only has so many calendar days to work. It's a big place, a lot of competing interests. But this legislation is something that, it's a seemingly small step, but it's a major way forward because, again, you're addressing the quality of life issues and you're using an educational choice vehicle to enhance the quality of life. It's ideal for children in the military. It's not a complete problem solver. I mean, they're still going to face challenges. There still may be, obviously, reassignment, relocation, but it's really going to smooth it over for a lot of families to be able to access this kind of support.
Aside from the general inertia, the general volume of business that Congress faces that you just mentioned, Peter, are there any institutional opponents to this? It would seem to me to be sort of like a mom and apple pie type of thing, but are there factions out there? Are there special interests out there that are working to oppose it?
You know, unfortunately, there is. The teacher unions, in particular, view anything that smacks of opportunity in education, alternatives to public education, anything like that, in even the smallest way, they view as Armageddon, as the end of public education as we know it, which is absurd. They're just grotesque at embellishment when they oppose things. And part of what also involves in this particular bill is that the money that the federal government uses to support school districts that serve a lot of military families, a portion of that money would shift into the education savings account if a family chose it. So you have school districts that oppose the idea of any money being taken from them, and that's how they view it. It's sort of their money as opposed to the family's money. I mean, the money exists to educate children. If the family wants to pull the child out and do something else educationally, the money should follow the child. The school district isn't entitled to this, but they view themselves as entitled to money. They never want less. They always want more. So you have school districts and you have teacher unions opposing any kind of educational opportunity outside of their control. And it's very selfish, and it's, again, it's usually very embellished and very negative rhetoric. And so that they put up a fight, and that's really the obstacle to all kinds of school choice opportunity, and including even when it comes to helping our military families. They're that selfish, the opponents of helping our military families.
Peter Murphy is Vice President of Policy at the Invest in Education Foundation. Peter, a couple of quick words about the foundation, and where can folks go on the web to learn more about you?
InvestInEducation.org is our website, InvestInEducation.org. And we also have something called EdTaxCredit50.org. It's one of our initiatives to provide a scholarship, a tax credit nationally as well, another school choice vehicle to help more families, EdTaxCredit50.org. So appreciate the opportunity to be on today.
Peter Murphy of the Invest in Education Foundation. Peter, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Andy Roth, standing by at the offices of the Club for Growth. Andy, good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me, Loman.
Well, Andy, we talked last week about the fact that Congress passed this gigundous omnibus spending bill. It busted all of the sequester, all of the budget caps. The president briefly threatened to veto it, then he didn't. Everybody's upset that Republicans passed it. what can be done, and President Trump has expressed great frustration with the process, what can be done to start sort of reeling this in a little bit?
First and foremost, Congress just needs to do its job, and they're extremely incapable of doing it. The budget process is severely broken. That's why we're having all of these shutdowns and or threats of shutdowns. And so what they end up doing in their paralyzed state is that they pass a huge omnibus bill. And this is a Christmas tree of all sorts. You're spending $1.3 trillion on all sorts of things in this bill. And members of Congress are not given the opportunity to amend it. They're not given much time to read the bill. And they're not given much time to debate the bill. And that's how broken things are. So what we said when the omnibus was being debated is that conservative or liberal, Republican or Democrat, you should not have voted for that bill simply because you didn't get a chance to read it or debate it or amend it or do or partake in anything. So they should have rejected it just out of the faulty process. But it did pass, and President Trump did sign it, even though he did threaten to veto it. But he did register his disgust for the omnibus, and he said that he was not going to sign another one again. And good for him. That's exactly what he shouldn't do.
The president has been asking now for something that's called line item veto authority. Can you explain for our listeners what a line item veto is and why would it be important for a president like Donald Trump to have that power?
Obviously, a president has the ability to veto legislation, but right now he can only veto all of it. So he either accepts all of it or he rejects all of it. But the line item veto gives him the authority to, which he does not currently have, would give him the authority to reject parts of the bill that he doesn't like. This is usually to help remove wasteful spending from a bill. I might get this wrong, but I believe that 40 U.S. governors have line item veto authority. I know that it's definitely prevalent in states like Wisconsin and South Carolina. The Republican wave of 1994, the Gingrich Republican Revolution, they campaigned on the line item veto, and they passed it into law, ironically giving it to a Democrat president, Bill Clinton. And Clinton did have it for a while, and he did exercise his authority with it a few times, but then the Supreme Court rejected it, saying that it was unconstitutional. Remarkably, there were conservatives and liberals on the bench who rejected it as unconstitutional. In fact, I believe the late Antonin Scalia did not agree with it. So if Republicans in Congress wanted to bring the line item veto back to give to President Trump and future presidents, they would have to overcome that concern. And there are two options that they could do. They could, one, pass it again and dare the new Supreme Court that has experienced changes in its membership since the 1990s to reject it again. Or they could give the president rescission authority. And this is basically the line item veto with constitutional protection, supposedly. And basically what would happen is that under the way that the line item veto works now is that you would pass a bill, the president would line item, strike out parts of it, and then the rest would go into law. That was deemed unconstitutional. With a rescission authority, the bill would pass Congress. It would go to the president's desk. The president would then line item veto the things he didn't like. And then those things would go back to Congress, and they would have to approve or reject those various line item vetoes. And that's what rescission authority is. And then once all of those things are settled, then the bill would pass into law, or the various things, the vetoes would get rejected or approved. And so basically that's an option that Republicans can give to Trump now.
As we look at that, the next big deadline here is October 1st, which is the start of the new federal fiscal year. Andy, it's been quite a number of years now since we've actually had a federal budget passed at all, let alone on time. So this line item veto authority, is that something that could be put into place for President Trump for the next round of budget talks?
I think it could definitely be debated. I think that there are a ton of Republicans, if not almost all of them, who I think would support a line item veto, even in the hands of a Democrat president. But remember that the Senate does have the 60-vote threshold in order to pass legislation. So they could debate the line item veto and then dare a lot of red state Democrats in the Senate to either support it or oppose it and then answer the voters on why they did it. But if that didn't work, then obviously Senate Republicans could get rid of the filibuster altogether, which is something that has been discussed for a few years now. So there are various options out there. It would be my hope, though, that we could pass some sort of line item veto eventually. I think it's a vital tool that would keep the government in check, if only modestly.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. And Andy, as usual, tell us a little bit about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, from all 50 states in the union, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, we'll talk with you next week.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
A number of companies are working to develop driverless vehicles, but fatalities during testing has resulted in efforts to slow down or stop development of the technology. Eric Baim of Reason Magazine weighs in.
If March 18th was a typical day on America's roadways, and there's no reason to think that it wasn't, then that means somewhere between 90 and 100 people lost their lives in car accidents during that 24-hour span. And unless you were unfortunate enough to know one of them, you probably didn't hear about any of those fatal accidents. But you probably have heard about one that happened in Tempe, Arizona. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Baim with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. There's no guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at autonomous cars and the fact that, honestly, we should keep testing them even if they kill people. That's right, even if they kill people, like one autonomous vehicle did on March 18th in Tempe, Arizona. That's when and where Elaine Hertzberg, a 49-year-old Arizona woman, was struck and killed by a vehicle that was being tested by Uber, one of Uber's autonomous vehicles. Video of the incident shows that Hertzberg was crossing the street outside of designated crosswalks and that neither the self-driving car nor the human backup driver who was stationed in the front seat had time to detect Hertzberg's presence before the collision took place. Police have determined that the car, the self-driving car owned by Uber, was not at fault for the accident, but Uber has now reached a settlement, an undisclosed settlement, with Hertzberg's family. Now, look, this was an unfortunate accident, and it is, unfortunately, the kind that happens every day on roads all over America. The fact that the vehicle was a self-driving car has made this accident a national story, while those other 90 to 100 fatalities every single day are not big-time newsmakers, except for the fact that they hold up traffic. But policymakers should be careful not to overreact to this one incident. Self-driving cars have an incredible potential to actually save lives, and officials should not be putting that prospect at risk. But we're already seeing that overreaction take place. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey, a Republican, has suspended Uber's self-driving car testing privileges in his state. He is citing concerns about public safety. That move is a major step back from his embrace of self-driving vehicles before. Ducey had actually welcomed Uber and Google and other autonomous driving tests into Arizona after they were subjected to strict regulation in California a few years ago. Meanwhile, there are four state senators in Minnesota who have introduced a bill this week to ban autonomous vehicles from being tested there. Arizona has confirmed concerns, says State Senator Jim Abeler. He says that he's been very worried about autonomous cars and that, frankly, the idea of driving home while you're in the back seat is just a recipe for trouble. Unfortunately for Senator Jim Abeler of Minnesota, the bigger recipe for trouble is driving around with him in the driver's seat. Yes, that's right. To err is human, and human error is the cause of 90% of car accidents. We should be concerned about automated vehicles, but we should be terrified of human drivers. And if driverless cars can amass a better safety record than what humans do, they will literally save lives. Unfortunately, those future lives saved are somewhat invisible relative to lives lost in the present, which have significantly more weight for governors, legislators, and regulators. But we're certainly not going to ban human driving over a handful of of accidents, and in fact, there are far more than a handful of accidents every single day. In aggregate, car accidents are actually a massive public health problem. And it isn't just the deaths that they cause that we should be worried about. Americans spend more than $230 billion annually to cover the costs of accidents, which accounts for somewhere between 2 and 3% of the country's gross domestic product. Driverless cars won't be perfect, and we shouldn't expect them to be, and in fact, they haven't been. This incident that happened earlier this month in Arizona is not the first fatal accident involving a self-driving car. A Tesla autopilot car that was undergoing beta testing back in 2016 accidentally accelerated and slammed its driver, killed its driver when it slammed beneath the wheels of a tractor trailer. There have been other non-fatal accidents in places like Toronto and Pittsburgh and San Francisco where autonomous cars have also been tested. So yes, they're not perfect. And certainly they won't be perfect when human beings are darting into traffic on dimly lit streets where there's no crosswalks, as this Arizona woman apparently did. But we shouldn't expect perfection because we don't get perfection from human drivers either. And if autonomous cars can be better than human drivers, that's a pretty low bar, then they should continue to be tested and developed because they will only get better as they go. Now, even if you're skeptical of the assumption that computers can drive better than humans, the only way to find out for sure who's right is to allow more testing, to do what people like Arizona Governor Doug Ducey are refusing to do, which is to block the testing. As Megan McArdle of The Washington Post pointed out this week, Americans drove 3.2 trillion miles in 2016 with an average of 1.18 fatalities for every 100 million miles driven. That is a big sample size. And it's even larger when you consider that driverless cars, ever since they began being tested, have driven fewer than 100 million miles on the road. So if there's a little more than one fatality for every 100 million miles driven with human drivers, then that means that autonomous cars are pretty much in line with that right now. And the sample size that we're working with there is actually incredibly small, even if it sounds like a lot. To get a better perspective, we need a bigger sample, and you can only get a bigger sample if you continue to test. Prior to the accident this month, Arizonans seemed pretty willing to give autonomous vehicles that chance. A February poll from the Consumer Choice Center found that 51% of Arizonans favored testing self-driving cars in the state and 42% were opposed. It's actually, there's an interesting split on the ages there. Residents under age 44, from 18 to 44, are far more likely to support self-driving cars than older residents are, which I guess makes a degree of sense. Younger Americans, younger people in general, are more okay with technology and more used to having it be an important part of their lives, an integral part of their lives. I wonder if those feelings will shift in the wake of Hertzberg's death, but I also hope that officials will keep the long-term perspective in mind. As Reason's Ron Bailey wrote back in 2016, and he's a frequent guest on the show here, he wrote in 2016 that driverless cars have the potential to make us richer, less stressed, more independent, and safer. Unless, he added, lawmakers and regulators manage to screw everything up. I wonder if in the wake of this tragic accident in Arizona, they will resist the urge to do so. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Thanks for joining us here, folks. We'll be back next week with a guest on another edition of American Radio Journal.
As Christians around the world celebrate Easter, it is interesting how our last three presidents have marked the holy day. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA fills us in on this American Radio Journal commentary.
This coming Sunday is Easter, the most important day of the year in the Christian calendar, because it was on the first Easter Sunday that Jesus Christ rose from the dead and demonstrated his divinity in a manner that was dispositive, not merely probative, for those who profess to be Christians. A dispositive event or fact is one that clearly settles an issue. Literally, it disposes of the issue. A probative event or fact is one that leads towards or supports a given resolution of an issue, but it does not in and of itself fully settle it. Turning water into wine, healing the sick, and walking on water may be dispositive for some, but for most people, they are instances that tend to confirm Jesus' divinity, but do not dispositively settle the matter. They may conceivably be acts that were either described inaccurately or misunderstood by witnesses, even if sincerely so. They may be evidence of God at work and that Jesus was in some way an instrument of God, but they do not definitively prove that Jesus himself was divine. In other words, they are probative. While nearly all U.S. presidents have described themselves as Christians, and everyone without exception in the past 100 years does so, They do not share a uniform theology. Looking closely at the presidents in the 21st century, their official statements or proclamations on Easter provide a fascinating glimpse into their real beliefs. For instance, it is very easy to find all 8 statements on Easter by George W. Bush. They are officially recorded as presidential proclamations, with specific numbers that identify each among the hundreds of official presidential proclamations. Here is one that is representative of the 8. I send greetings to everyone observing Easter this year. During this joyful season of new life and renewal, Christians around the world celebrate the central event of their faith, the resurrection of Jesus Christ, whom Christians believe is the Messiah, the Son of God. The life and teachings of Jesus have inspired people throughout the ages to strive for a better world and a more meaningful life. Jesus' death stands out in history as the perfect example of unconditional love. The 4 Gospels of the Christian Bible recount Jesus' amazing life, his miraculous death, resurrection, and ascension, and his unending offer of salvation to all. The story of Jesus' wonderful resurrection comes alive again for Christians each year at Easter. Easter Sunday commemorates in song and celebration the joy and promise of Christ's triumph over evil and death. President Barack Obama did not issue official presidential proclamations on the 8 Easters during his term of office, but he did use his weekly radio address and other occasions to offer personal comments on Easter. His Easter remarks of 2009 were included as part of a broader address that referred to international conflicts, NATO, terrorism, and the global economic crisis. The difference between his and President George W. Bush's are striking. Quote, I speak to you today during a time that is holy and filled with meaning for believers around the world. Earlier this week, Jewish people gathered with family and friends to recite the stories of their ancestors' struggle and ultimate liberation. Tomorrow, Christians of all denominations will come together to rejoice and remember the resurrection of Jesus Christ. These are 2 very different holidays with their own very different traditions, but it seems fitting that we mark them both during the same week, for in a larger sense, they are both moments of reflection and renewal. They are both occasions to think more deeply about the obligations we have to ourselves and the obligations we have to one another, no matter who we are, where we come from, or what faith we practice. Close quote. While he calls the Easter and Passover holidays holy, there's no reference to Jesus' resurrection or his divinity. As far as I could tell, President Trump made no official remarks last year, his first Easter in office. I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts about these 3 presidents and how they address Easter. I will now close with 2 simple phrases. The first is, Happy Easter, and the second is the greeting that many Christians still exchange with one another on Easter Sunday. He is risen. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include WWOW-AM in Conneaut, Ohio, WTIM-AM in Somerville, Massachusetts, along with WXMC-AM in Troy Hills, New Jersey. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.